This is Ms. G. I am bringing Left Hanging live tonight here on January 17th, 2012. Happy New Year. And tonight's stories are in accordance with it being yesterday, being Martin Luther King Day, his birthday, Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday. So I'll give you a second to get settled, and I'll be right back with my first story by Miss Betty Rice Hughes. A Negro Tourist in Dixie. Stay tuned here at Left Hanging with Ms. G. I'm back. This is Ms. G, and I am bringing you Left Hanging here at 104.3. Tonight's first story is by Betty Rice Hughes. It was originally published in 1962 in The Reporter. It's titled A Negro Tourist in Dixie. It was mostly curiosity that caused me to set out from Los Angeles on a tour of the South by bus last November, just 12 days after the Interstate Commerce Commission's order went into effect, forbidding separation by races in interstate buses and terminals. My trip lasted 6 weeks and carried me through Oklahoma, Arkansas, Tennessee, the Carolinas, Florida, Georgia, Alabama, and part of Mississippi. The purpose of my tour was twofold. I wanted to see firsthand how many southern states were complying with the ICC ruling, and I wanted to see if a female Negro tourist traveling alone, unheralded, and unprepared for, would receive a different reception from that which had greeted the Freedom Riders. The trip began uneventfully. I traveled straight across the middle of Arkansas and saw no white or colored signs on the restrooms or waiting rooms. I was certainly not welcomed with open arms, and I could sense the hostility brought on by my presence in some towns. But I was served without incident. In Memphis, I encountered the first separate waiting rooms. There were stares from other passengers when I went into the main waiting rooms, but nothing more. I was served in the restaurant. In Mount Eagle, Tennessee, I saw the first evidence that the colored and white signs had recently been removed. After a while, I began to look for the different methods used in covering over those signs. In no case were new ones installed. Above these doors of west rooms, the colored designations were often painted out or covered with metal strips, leaving an off-centered men and women. But there were still four rooms. Their racial backgrounds identifiable by location and by the length of the covered-up area on the signs. I realize now that my naivety about Southern customs was a protective cloak. Even when white people appeared to ignore me, my actions often drew stares from Negro passengers. I was subjected to my first real attempt at discrimination in Florence, South Carolina. I had transferred from Trailways to Greyhound. The bus was an express from New York City and was crowded with passengers going home for Thanksgiving. Florence was the first stop in South Carolina. I had not intended at first to go inside the terminal. I wasn't particularly hungry, and I was a little short of money anyway. But a Negro girl sitting next to me, a native South Carolinian, said she wished she had a Coke and a hot dog, and I thought I might as well join her. I asked her to go in with me, but she refused and asked me to bring her a sandwich. There were no signs, so I went in the waiting room in front of me and on through to the restaurant, just as I had been doing in other cities. As I walked into the restaurant, the cashier looked up, turned red, and started pointing and yelling. There's another one just across the waiting room. Since she was looking everywhere but directly at me, I wasn't entirely sure at first that she was talking to me. I thought she might be talking to an elderly white man in front of me. So did the poor old man, who turned and went out. Then I noticed a young Negro fellow who had been following me stop abruptly and leave the restaurant. There was no mistake about whom she meant. Stalling for time, I feigned innocence and asked her, "What's the difference? This one's fine, thank you." The cashier gave me a look that was anything but cordial, but turned away from me to attend to her cash register. As soon as I moved toward the counter, a tall white counterman followed, and all the myths, half-truths, exaggerations, and facts concerning treatment of Negroes in the South swarmed through my mind. He kept repeating, "There's another one for you over there through that door." "What's the difference?" I asked him. "All I want is a sandwich." "Just go on over to the other restaurant and you'll find out the difference," he said. He began to get redder, and I got scared. "I don't want to stand here and argue. Just go on over to the other restaurant where you belong." "I'm not arguing," I insisted. "But one's as good as another with me." At this point, he stalked off, and I felt sure he was going to get the police or the White Citizens Council or the Ku Klux Klan, maybe all three. To my surprise, all he did was go back behind the lunch counter. By now, most of the white passengers were pointedly staring at their food. No one uttered a word, and only a few even glanced at me. A customer got up from the counter, and I sat down. I had no idea what was going to happen. I was sure I would not get service, but I did not intend to leave and give the counterman the satisfaction of saying that I went because of his threats. So I sat. Just before the end of the lunch break, a waitress came over and took my order. My bravado had paid off. Nevertheless, when I returned to the bus, I was no longer optimistic about what might lie ahead as we moved farther south, and I dreaded the next bus stop. And yet at Charleston and Savannah, much farther south, I received service in restaurants and went into the main waiting rooms and restrooms without incident. The other Negro passengers who went to the waiting rooms formerly designated as colored had started watching to see what I was going to do at the rest and lunch stops. Several of them asked me, "Are you writing for us?" I said that in a sense I was, but no one offered to go into the main waiting room area with me. Throughout Florida, all colored and white signs had been removed, and at the terminals that had separate waiting rooms, I received service along with the other passengers. My courage had somewhat returned, so once again, I was not prepared for trouble. When I entered the main restaurant in Tallahassee, a white man yelled back to the kitchen, "Tell Roy to come here." Roy came out of the kitchen with his dishwasher's apron on. We were both black. So Roy could serve me. The ICC ruling would be obeyed, and the management could save face. Very neat. I had read of this happening to other Negro travelers in the South, but when I was faced with a real live instance, I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. Roy came over, very nervous, and asked for my order. I smiled at him and said, "What are they doing? Making you the scapegoat?" No answer. So I put on a sober face and gave him my order. My first stop in Alabama was at Dothan. I had been worrying about Alabama all night. When we got to the terminal, I saw no white or colored signs, and when the other Negro passengers went into the one segregated waiting room, I went into the main waiting room and then into the restaurant. As I sat down, I noticed the ICC ruling against discrimination on the wall, and I must say it made me feel much better. The waitress took my order while a Negro cook stared through the service door from the kitchen. After she had brought my coffee, I heard the waitress say to a white woman sitting at the counter, "I know how you feel. I don't like it either, but there ain't nothing we can do about it." The white woman got up and walked out. But after I had sat over my coffee about 5 minutes, the waitress came over, smiled at me, and asked me where I was from. She stayed and talked. How did I like the South? Where was I going? As I was paying my check, she called after me, I hope you have a nice trip. From Dothan, I traveled northeast into Georgia. At the major stops in that state, Atlanta, Macon, Savannah, I saw the separate waiting rooms, but no white or colored signs in the terminals. I went into the main waiting rooms and adjoining restrooms and ate in the main restaurants. But at the smaller towns where the Interstate Express buses do not stop, the signs were still up. And all along the highway, I noticed that Negroes and whites were still using separate waiting rooms. Discrimination is still rigidly enforced for passengers traveling within the state of Georgia. Only the interstate Negro passengers would sit in the middle or to the front of the bus. All other Negro passengers moved as far back as they could, even though posted at the bus entrance was a sign stating that according to the ICC ruling, passengers were to be seated without regard to race, color, creed, or national origin. In Georgia and also in Alabama, I often saw white passengers stand up in the aisles for miles rather than sit down beside a Negro passenger. I also saw a Negro woman stand for 2 hours rather than take an empty seat beside a white passenger. At Winfield, Alabama, a white man had been holding the door of the restaurant open for the bus passengers, but he took one look at me and slammed the door in my face. Nothing was said by the driver, by me, or by the bus passengers following. I just opened the door and went into the restaurant. As soon as I had sat down, the waitress was in front of me to take my order. I smiled to myself. This sort of hospitality was nearly as hard to bear as more direct forms of hostility, but I was given service. Of all the towns I stopped in, I was most apprehensive about Anniston, Alabama. It had been made international headlines 6 months previously when a bus carrying freedom riders had been burned. There were stares and an oppressive silence as I sat and drank my buttermilk. Negro passengers who had gone to the colored waiting room would glance in at me, but I was served. When the Greyhound Express bus to Los Angeles reached Mississippi, it took what seemed to me a curious route. It certainly would have been faster to go from Alabama straight through the middle of Mississippi and then down to El Paso, the main transfer point for all southern routes. However, instead we took a sharp turn northward, went across the northeastern tip of Mississippi, and without making a rest stop, ended back up north in Memphis before we turned back down to El Paso. In other words, interstate passengers going from east to the west by Greyhound bus over the southern route never set foot on Mississippi soil. On the return trip through Arkansas and Texas, I was given service in all the restaurants. At Dallas, there were separate waiting rooms, but both Negro and white passengers, as well as Indians and Mexicans, were in the main one. There were, however, no Negroes eating in the main cafeteria during the time I was there. Frankly, I do not know whether the treatment I received was due to the fact that I was traveling in the wake of the Freedom Riders, or whether it was because I was traveling alone and without publicity. It may have been a combination of both. I felt that the threat of violence was always there, particularly in South Carolina, Georgia, and Alabama, but somehow it never erupted. My own feeling, as one who was naturally interested in securing a full rights for all members of my race, is that the advances that have been won through group action may now be reinforced by individual action. I believe that what must happen next is for Southern white people to get used to seeing Negroes in waiting rooms, restrooms, and cafeterias. And it is just as necessary, it seems to me, for Southern Negroes to get used to seeing other Negroes bypassing the segregated areas so that they may take courage and insist on the best facilities and service available for their money. You've just heard me read A Negro Tourist in Dixie by Miss Betty Rice Hughes, originally published in The Reporter, April 26, 1962. This is Ms. G. I'm bringing you Left Hanging here at 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska, and I'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
And hello, this is Ms. G. I am back with some rather interesting music. And I have another story for you tonight. This one is titled, The Drums of Africa. It's a short story by Bridget Arlette Rahman. It was early winter, and London was freezing cold. A Natalie, an elegant young Frenchwoman, had been shopping in Bond Street for the unique gifts she loved to send to people she knew would celebrate Christmas. Bond Street was a great place to find the highest quality as well as prestige-branded products. She had seen earlier, at her favorite jeweler's, window displays, some turquoise and gold beetles, Egyptian in 18 carats, gold and sapphires. They were lovely and truly unique to the connoisseur she was. Her friends would love those. She entered the jeweler's shop, which had just opened. As she entered, the manager of the shop welcomed her with great warmth. After all, she was a regular customer, and she was stunning. She had an aura around her that warmed any place she was in. Mr. Thompson called immediately for a tea tray, and Natalie was used to the courtesy of this so British gentleman. And so she relaxed into the sofa chair and removed her white kid gloves to pick up the porcelain cup of tea. The manager could not help noticing on her fingers the rings he had sold her over the last 3 years. On her manicured hands, the diamond rings set with several solitaire diamonds, sapphires, and emeralds were as dazzling and beautiful as ever. Boucheron was indeed the best jeweler there was in the world. Today she had worn only fresh water pearls on her ears and neck, and gave her a youthful and yet sober look. She looked ravishing. It always warmed the heart of the manager to see that lovely women were wearing items from his shop. And Natalie was certainly a walking advertisement. She looked stunning in those. And Natalie drank her lemon tea slowly, while the manager showed her the Egyptian pieces she wanted. And Natalie looked keenly at the pieces and said softly, "Yes, those will do. How many do you presently in stock?" The manager gleefully replied, "Four, Mademoiselle Natalie. We have just four." And Natalie smiled. "And so, Monsieur Thompson, yes, I shall take the four. Just add the wrapping separately. I will do the wrapping myself." The manager laughed. He knew her well. She loved doing the packing of the gifts herself. She never wanted it any other way. And he was only too willing to oblige such a courteous customer. As the shop assistant was instructed to pack as Natalie had requested, the manager took advantage of the free moment to show Natalie a new piece, a recent arrival, a forearm snake type bracelet, also a piece from Egypt. It had an intrinsic handwork, and Natalie looked at it for a while and asked, "How much?" The manager told the price, and Natalie said, "Yes, I want it too, but this one, please have it wrapped up." The manager laughed and said, "Yes, we always do wrap the gifts you make to yourself, and we spare no efforts in doing so." And Natalie gave back a brief smile. It was enough. The manager knew that Natalie was a discreet and mysterious woman. She never gave anything of herself readily, only soft smiles. But he liked her a lot. She was easy to deal with and very kind. She always inquired about his wife and children. As they were in the process of completing the purchase, suddenly the face of the manager froze. The security men were going hurriedly towards the entrance door, and Natalie casually glanced towards the place of the commotion. There stood in the doorway a tall, black-skinned man, over 6 feet tall. He made a strange impression, not only because of his unusual height, but also for the fact that he was dressed with a sort of cape where there were only openings for the head and for the arms. It seemed to have been made from a brown, rough fabric, very much like a blanket, and the man wore only a pair of open sandals. And Natalie immediately felt the cold invading her as she shivered for the man. How did he walk around in those open sandals? The winter of London is always very freezing, and she felt that he would surely catch his death dressed that way. His cloth came only to the calves of his legs, and his arms were bare. He had around his strong neck a cord with an animal tooth, so it seems, from far away. She could not see much more as the man was chased away. She was sad because, oddly, she felt that she should somehow explain to him about the weather and to teach him somehow how to dress himself more adequately. She shivered. Did he not feel the cold? The commotion was soon forgotten. An Englishwoman entered the shop. She was wearing an interesting hat that was pleasing to Natalie. She seemed nice enough. But from the strained face of the manager, Natalie could understand that she was not an easy customer to please. Natalie was done. She bade farewell to the manager, but the manager insisted to accompany Natalie to the door, much to the annoyance of the lady. The manager said, "Mademoiselle Natalie, I wish you a wonderful day, and I shall convey your wishes to my wife." As she went into the Bond Street, she realized how cold it was. She was wearing a jersey suit of mauve color with a white kid jacket and gloves and boots. Yet she was felt so very cold. She had never felt that very cold on previous winters. It was just 11 a.m. in the morning, and many people were walking in Bond Street. The street was always fashionably lively. She saw in some of the boutiques some famous lady singer, Lulu, and a model, too. But she was shivering, and she thought that she could do with some warm beverage at an Italian restaurant she sometimes went to while shopping in the area. She entered, and the waiter greeted her. He was a charming young Italian man with an eye for pretty ladies. He always courted Natalie when she came in the place, messing around her like he did to no other customer. Natalie smiled. He was happy. She said, "Alberto, please, I am feeling cold. I need a very hot cappuccino." It was a busy place, but she could hear Alberto making an Italian joke about Natalie being cold, how he could resolve the problem. She did not mind him. She was used to him. He meant no insult. He was a good man, a bit of a playboy, like all Italians. Soon he brought her coffee, and she took her cup in her two hands so that the warmth would reach her heart faster. As she was drinking, she noticed that Alberto was pacing nervously the aisle up and down with an angry face. She was puzzled, because Alberto was always in a pleasant mood. She had never seen him that upset. She called him and told Alberto, "I am going to refresh myself in the powder room. Meanwhile, please, I need one more coffee and a croissant." She had already stood up, and he was pleased to find her so close to him. She was tall and slender. Her skin was so perfect, her smile, her hair, and he was taken by her. He could smell her perfume. She always wore that perfume. What a beautiful woman, Alberto thought. What a shame she was always alone. Not once did he see her accompanied by a man. Many had tried to befriend her while she had been here on previous occasions, but she always remained so aloof. Even Sergio, the owner of the restaurant, was crazy about her, but she laughed him away gently. Alberto pondered often about this. Sergio was really attracted by Natalie, and Sergio had a lot of money, too. Every day he was making a fortune from his restaurant. Till she did not care for his advances or declarations of love. She would even refuse when Sergio gave orders that her bills be on the house. She insisted to pay, always. And Natalie walked past other tables on her way to the powder room. As she did so, she was surprised to see the same tall black man that had been ousted from the jeweler's shop a little while ago, seated at one of the big tables by the wall on his own. His back was to her, so she moved on and climbed down the stairs to go to the powder room. She refreshed herself, and yes, she understood why Alberto was angry. She says, "Italians are a bit racist and do not take well to darker skins, one of the many stigmas of their colonialist past," she thought. As she came back up, she found that the black man was still seated, his eyes flashing with anger, staring at Alberto. She felt the tension. She understood the conflict right away. It was easy to understand why Alberto was annoyed. Well, the black man was eating with his hands. He had ordered a rare T-bone steak, and blood was dripping from the corner of his mouth, too. Not a pretty sight. And other customers were moving away from this aisle of the restaurant to other tables. Somehow, Natalie felt sorry. The black man looked so alone, so isolated. He was a man like every other. She had never understood the issue of color of the skin. Did it matter that much? As she arrived by the black man's table, she heard herself asking him, "Do you mind if I sit here and have my coffee?" To Natalie's surprise, the black man spoke in perfect English and replied, "By all means, miss, make yourself comfortable." She signaled Alberto to bring her coffee and croissant over to the black man's table. Alberto was furious. As he did so, Natalie looked him in the eyes and flashed a smile. Alberto was happy and went away singing. The black man was no fool. "It seems you have overpowered the angry idiot very easily." And Natalie controlled herself, because as the black man spoke, she could see real close his smile, his teeth bloody from the T-bone steak still in his hand. It was no pretty sight, but Natalie's face remained placid. She deliberately smiled and drank her coffee nonchalantly. The black man continued, "You are not from England. Your accent is different. Where are you from?" And Natalie replied gently, "I was born in France. My name is Natalie." The black man smiled back. "I am glad to have met you, Natalie. My name is Mobutu." And Natalie said, "This name is very familiar." Mobutu said, "In Europe I do not know, but in Africa, yes. Our family name is well known. My father is a king in Africa. I am his eldest son. I am studying law here. I am in my second year." She listened to the warm tone of his voice and casually asked, hiding her inner pain, that he would feel cold in London dressed that way. "Yes, how do you like the place?" Something in her wanted him to talk. The sound of his voice soothed her anguish in a way that was hard to describe. Mobutu said, "I have no opinion. My father told me to come here and study, and that is exactly what I am doing. Besides this, I know nothing. I form no opinion. What for?" Natalie recognized this man, a strong will and pride. He felt so close to her. Mobutu had finished his meal, and Alberto came to remove the dishes and clean the bloody mess on the table, murmuring Italian insults in his breath. Mobutu looked at him furiously. Natalie had too finished her coffee, and Alberto asked, "Would you like another coffee, mademoiselle? It is so cold." Before she could answer, Mobutu asked, "How much is a coffee?" Alberto told him dryly the cost. "Please bring one coffee for Natalie." Alberto sneered. "For you, too?" "No, I said bring one for Miss Natalie," Mobutu said sharply. Alberto's face was red, and Natalie knew he was ready to explode. "Alberto, it is nice. Yes, I would love to accept a coffee from Mr. Mobutu, at the sole condition that Mr. Mobutu accept a tea from me." The black man smiled. "Yes, of course, I should have known you are a traitor, aren't you? Thank you. And Natalie, yes, I would love to have a tea." And Natalie felt the anguish coming back. She already knew that he was a profoundly proud man. He apparently did not have big means to live here, and she felt so cold, remembering how he has so inadequately dressed in the winter with open sandals. She wished she could do something for him, but she already knew it would be an insult to Mobutu. She kept quiet. The coffee and tea came promptly. As they drank, Mobutu asked, "Anatoly, did you sit here because you felt sorry for me?" Anatoly looked deeply in the eyes of this unusual man. "Well, Mobutu, in a way, yes, because you see, to be in a place and not to conform to its way of living can be so hard." Mobutu asked, "What do you mean?" Anatoly said, "Oh, for one thing, you do not dress like British people." Mobutu replied curtly, "And when you people come to my country, they do not dress like us. Rather, they want to force us to wear trousers and jeans." Anatoly retorted with a twinkle in her eye, "Ah, Mobutu, you eat with your hands. You are an intelligent and very strong man. Do not fool me with your ready-made explanation. That much you understand, yes?" Mobutu smiled and replied proudly, "Well, Anatoly, my hands are clean, probably cleaner than their so-called forks and knives." Anatoly said, "Yes, so you do not want to play by their rules and you get stressed unnecessarily. I feel pain, Mobutu, watching you walking with open sandals in the winter." This has been Ms. G bringing you Left Hanging, and I have to end now. And I will be back next week. And I give you new letters on the air already in progress. Good night. Until next time.
Blueprint for me to talk about those things as well.
Yeah. Dwayne, that.
Mobutu said, "Yes, every day I may be stressed, but stress is no big deal for me. What matters to me is that I do never betray our own traditions for my own comfort. I am the son of a king. They may treat me like a pauper here, but the blood in my veins is the blood of a king. I shall never bow my head to tie my shoelaces. Do you get it, Anatoly? Do not feel anguish on my account, because I feel none for myself. I am just fine the way I am." Mobutu looked into Anatoly's eyes. He paused pensively for a while. "Anatoly, I saw you earlier. I felt like talking to you, but they would not let me in that shop. Did you see me then?" Anatoly replied, "Yes, Mobutu, I did see you there. Why did you want to see me? It is strange." Mobutu replied gently, "It may be strange to you yet. Yes, I had to talk to you. You are so different from others. As you walked, I could see only you, none else. Something in you called on me." Anatoly smiled. "Maybe it is because I wore a purple suit with white. Maybe I was the attractive woman you always dreamt of meeting." Mobutu looked serious and did not take to the joke. He said, "Anatoly, I am the son of a king, the guardian of our ancient traditions and wisdoms. I know much about the ills of the soul. You are in great pain." Anatoly lowered her eyes, felt a sharp stab in her heart. She thought for a while and said, "Mobutu, pain is part of life. It is our human condition." Mobutu's eyes flashed with anger. "Why do you evade me, Anatoly? You know what I mean. Your soul is wounded and your heart has been bled dry. I could feel your aura from where I was. You are all kindness, yet also all pain. Tell me about it, Anatoly. Please, I must help you." The word "please" that came from the lips of the son of a foreign king felt like another stab in her heart. "Mobutu, I cannot talk those things here," Mobutu urged. "Yes, you can. Drink your coffee slowly. And when you feel the warm liquid finding its way in you, feel how it dissolves all your frights. Open up to me. I want to help you, really." His face was tense, his eyes lit with a deep light as if coming from the depth of times. Anatoly drank her coffee slowly. She felt well, safe with Mobutu. His face was gentle in spite of the traditional tribal carvings they made on his cheek. He had very intelligent and compassionate eyes. She said, "Mobutu, you have come too late. The The pain cannot be taken away. My soul has absorbed it like a sponge. It is too late now. He said, I know you are in terrible pain. For how long more, Anatoly? As he said this, he started beating the top of the table gently in a gentle, soothing drumbeat like was heard only by them both. She understood. She stood up, looking at him very hard in the eyes. His look was very pained, and tears were falling down his cheeks. She said, yes, Mobutu, yes. That night she went home. Her flat was very beautiful. She used to describe it jokingly to some of her invitees that congratulate her on her sense of interior design as a sanctuary for wounded blue birds. She went to take a long, scented bath and put on her most dazzling light blue dress. She loosened her hair and adorned it with an Austrian crystal pin. It was midnight. She went to lie on her bed. She closed her eyes gently. As she did so, she went into a deep sleep. There, in the depth of her sleep, she reached the dream where Mobutu had been waiting for her. He was there in Africa. He had dreams made of camel skin, soft skin, and he started the drumbeat, a call sent to her, a call returned by her heartbeat. He was at the drums for long, sweating heavily, his arms tensed by the effort. He played the drums harshly, urging her soul purge herself from the pain. It proved impossible. Anatoly was covered in sweat and was convulsing under the pain that was being disturbed in her soul. She screamed with anguish. Mobutu came towards her. She saw the sad and pained look in his eyes. The drumbeat went slow, and she realized that she and he had arrived to a new place, a water pond. As she looked into the water, she saw a reflection of a new birth. She was a deer with a broken leg. A royal Bengal tiger was ready nearby to pounce and eat her alive. Then she saw Mobutu reaching for his arch. He took one arrow and aimed at the heart of the tiger. The arrow killed the tiger on the spot, and he died almost instantly in a last huge roar. As the tiger died, Anatoly at last felt her soul at ease. All the pain was gone. She felt so light, so happy. And she turned her trusting deer eyes towards Mobutu. He was crying as he aimed at her heart. She died without a noise. In London at the same time, Anatoly heard, after the echoes of the drum beat, a dull silence. Then she felt an unendurable pain in her heart. Her body tensed. She remembered Mobutu's kind eyes and said, "Thank you, Mobutu. May God bless you always." Her heart had stopped beating. She was no more. In some furnished flat in London, one English man knocked angrily on his neighbor's door. A tall, dark-skinned man opened the door. He was in tears. The Englishman said, "Mr. Mobutu, please do not beat your drums at night. My kids cannot sleep. You do not seem all right, too. Is there anything the matter?" The black man replied, "No, John, everything is fine. I shall not play my drums for some time. Good night." You just heard me read The Drums of Africa, a short story by Bridget Arlette Rahman. This is Left Hanging with Ms. G. Good night.